Mr. Putin never intended peace. He always intended war. And so while we were relaxing, he was preparing. And so we had done almost three decades of relaxing, not investing, not buying new equipment, training less than we should. And then Mr. Putin invaded. And now we are in a very concentrated effort to try to regain readiness to be able to face a Russia that had demonstrated they would invade their neighbors. He always said that the strength of the army is the economy of the nation, because you won't be able to afford what you need to fight if you don't have a strong economy.
Militär aktuell, the podcast on military and security.
We were sitting in a luxurious hotel in the heart of Vienna, and we have a very special guest in this podcast episode, Philip Breedlove, a retired four-star general in the U.S. Air Force. Sir, thanks for sharing your precious time with us and the opportunity to have you on our podcast.
Well, I'm happy to be here, and I look forward to our conversation.
My name is Stefan Tesch. I'm hosting this show, and let me start briefly introducing you. You were from 2013 to 16 commander of the U.S. European Command and commander of NATO Supreme Allied Commander Europe. That means commanding U.S. troops in Europe and commanding NATO troops in Europe. You were based in Germany. Previously, you were commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe and vice chief of staff of the U.S. Air Force. General, let me start with a very personal question. You have a bachelor degree in civil engineering. Why have you decided many years ago to join the Air Force?
It's really kind of a interesting story. When I was a young, very young man, I read lots of books, lots and lots and lots of books. And I started reading about the fighter aces of World War I, Richthofen, Frank Luke, Roy Brown, all of the great fighter pilots and the airplanes they flew and the battles they flew. And I pretty soon read everything you could read about World War I. So then I started reading about World War II and fighter pilots in that war. And I decided at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old, all I ever wanted to do was fly a fighter airplane in the United States Air Force. And so I needed to have an education to do that. I came from a very low-income family. My father only had 5 years of education in primary school, so I knew that I had to win a scholarship to go to college. And so I fought very hard to win an Air Force scholarship to go to university. And I received that scholarship, went to the university, and got an engineering degree because my skills in high school were math, science, physics, chemistry. So I got an engineering degree. And that was really just to become commissioned as an officer in our military and then to go to pilot training.
And later on, your dream came true. You were a F-16 pilot, later an instructor pilot. For our listeners, how does it feel to fly a F-16?
Well, it's magnificent. It was, it really was beyond every expectation. You know, the fighter pilots of old and the airplanes of old were very maneuverable, and there was a lot of sort of one-on-one aerial combat involved with flying and so forth. And the F-16 in its time was the most maneuverable airplane in the world. It could pull the most G-forces in the world, sustain 9 Gs, which very few airplanes ever have done. And it was just a real joy to fly. As the airplane got older, it got better and better and more complicated and more capable. I flew every block of the airplane, which is just a description of the model, from the Block 5 to the Block 50. And the two airplanes are very different. And it was just an incredible warfighting machine, and it still is today. And new ones are being built every day.
When was the last time you were flying F-16?
So let's see. My last combat sortie was in 2003, and the last time I flew the F-16 was, I think, 2008 or 2009.
And I think you're pretty sad that some countries are putting it out of duty currently.
Yes, the earlier blocks of the airplanes are going out of duty in some countries, and a lot of those very early blocks of airplanes are being flown by the Ukrainian Air Force now, as nations donate them. But we are now building the Block 70 in America, which this is an incredible warfighting capability in the newest F-16s.
Let us switch now to our next topic. You were the commander of a U.S. European command and the commander of the NATO troops in Europe. For our listeners, could you be so kind to describe what's that job about?
Yeah. So it's a little bit complicated, and very few people understand that you are a dual commander. We say you wear two hats. And so you are really first being looked at as to will NATO accept you for the commander of the troops in NATO. When I was there, it was 28 nations. It's now 32. And so the suitability, the acceptability with the international militaries and the political leadership of the NATO nations, and if you are someone that America can expect that NATO will accept as the commander, then you are first nominated in America for the U.S. Senate to approve you as the U.S. European Command Commander. And then once the U.S. Senate approves you as the U.S. European Command Commander, your name is forwarded to NATO, and the NAC, the North Atlantic Council, looks and says suitable to be the SACUR. So the bottom line is they're looking for someone who has deep European experience. You may or may not remember my circumvitae, but I served in Europe 8 times. And I have daughters born in Deutschland and a son who played football in Spain, Italy, Germany, and Belgium. So, you know, we are a European family. And so I was chosen, and it was a magnificent job. Sadly, I was the SACUR, is how we say it. Supreme Allied Commander Europe is shortened to SACUR. I was the SACUR when Russia invaded Crimea, and then Russia, weeks later, invaded the Donbas in Ukraine.
So what was your job about during that time? Can you give us a...
So you're chosen for a 3-year tour of duty. And the first 4 or 5 months of my tour of duty as the SACUR, I was the commander of NATO troops in Afghanistan. And so when the U.S. government wanted to draw down the force presence in Afghanistan, for the first 4 or 5 months, my job was dealing with my toughest capital, which was my own back in America, on how we were going to draw down the forces in Afghanistan. And that process continued and was still a problem. But of course, about 5 months into my tour, Mr. Putin amassed his army, marched across an international border, and invaded one of his neighbors. And my whole life for the next 2.5 years was focused around how do we change NATO to be ready for a Russia and a leader of Russia, Mr. Putin, who has decided that he can invade his neighbors.
It's about like making a plan to defend Europe?
Well, we had plans. All the nations have some plans, but most of those plans were not very up to date because we thought we were in peace. We thought that Mr. Putin was a partner until we learned that he was not a partner. He never intended to be a partner, and he was using our down time to build up and be ready to invade in Europe. And that's exactly what he did. So what we had to do really was take a NATO that had been focused on Afghanistan and refocus it on the possibility of major land war on the European continent, just like we see now going on in Ukraine.
Do you like this podcast? Militär Aktuell is also available in print. The Austrian military magazine is published 4 times a year and reports on security policy issues, the Austrian armed forces, and the international defense industry. You will receive regular updates via our newsletter, on our social media channels, and of course on our website. Visit militäraktuell.at.
How did that affect you and your staff on an emotional level?
Well, this was a really tough time. And some of our problems were self-inflicted. Many of the big European nations had formed these big business relationships with Russia. And they did not want to think about fighting Russia because they had business relationships. One of our biggest NATO nations was trying to sell 2 multi-billion euro ships to Russia. And they didn't want to do anything to mess up their deal of selling those ships to Russia. So there was mixed emotions at first. In fact, everybody started saying, those are not Russians in Crimea. Those are someone else. They're not Russians. Well, we know they're Russians, and eventually Putin admitted they were Russians, but there was a lot of confliction. Now, when Russia invaded the Donbass, the second part of the invasion, in the late spring, early summer of 14, then the nation started to understand that Mr. Putin is not a partner, he's an enemy, and we have to begin to prepare to face the enemy. And that's when we started the work of changing the readiness and the force posture of NATO nations to be ready to meet Mr. Putin should he decide to invade a NATO nation.
As you mentioned, the readiness, how ready are the NATO troops?
We are much more ready today than we were in 2014. We were not ready then. Remember that we had been in almost 3 decades of what we called a peace dividend. Everybody thought peace was breaking out. Mr. Putin never intended peace. He always intended war. And so while we were relaxing, he was preparing. And so we had done almost 3 decades of relaxing, not investing, not buying new equipment, training less than we should. And then Mr. Putin invaded. And now we are in a very concentrated effort to try to regain readiness to be able to face a Russia that had demonstrated they would invade their neighbors.
What is, with all your experiences, the biggest strength and the biggest weakness of the NATO troops?
So we have nations and militaries, much like the military of this country, who have rich traditions in military capabilities, military leadership, military thinking. And I think one of the great values of the many nations in NATO is that experience they bring. I believe that one of the strongest things that no one ever talks about NATO nations is they have so many strong economies. One of our greatest leaders in our military, a man named Marty Dempsey, who was our senior commander at one point, he always said that the strength of the army is the economy of the nation, because you won't be able to afford what you need to fight if you don't have a strong economy. And so one of the great powers of the NATO nations are their strong economies. Italy is a great economy, but people all the time say Russia's economy is the same as Italy's economy. And if you look at then all the rest of NATO, you see that NATO has the capability and the capacity to be much stronger than Russia if they decide to.
And where do you see some weak points?
Well, some of our nations have not made the decision yet that they have to invest in their militaries. when the wall came down and when I was the SACEUR, only four nations in NATO were meeting their spending targets. Now, I'm told 23 nations in NATO are meeting their spending targets. And by this next summit, the big meeting of our most senior leaders, by the time of the next summit, it will be 28 of the nations that are meeting their investment targets. So this is an indication that people now understand. Once again, I've said it three times. I'm going to probably say it three or four more times. People have understood now that Putin is an enemy. He never intended peace, and he is living out his plan for Europe right now in the essentially gray zone invasion of Georgia, the gray zone invasion in other nations like mine even, and certainly in Moldova and Transnistria, and then the actual military invasion of Ukraine. This is what Mr. Putin intended.
He intended that, but what will be his future intention? What are the goals of Russia?
So I think I would refer you and your listeners to the two documents that Mr. Putin showed the West before this last major part of the world, the war. 3 years ago or so, a few months, right before this big invasion into Ukraine, Mr. Putin showed us two documents. He called them treaties. And he told the West, sign these. Or else, his words were, or there will be other means. And then he went to war because we didn't sign them. And if you read those two documents, he intends to reestablish essentially a Warsaw Pact setting with all of Americans and America's weapons out of his border nations, most of NATO's weapons out of his border nations, and a situation where he could control all of the border nations around him again. So I just commend you, rather than listen to me, you can read what Mr. Putin wrote. You can find it right online. And essentially, he seeks to establish the Warsaw Pact of old and having a hegemonic capability to drive and control those nations around him.
And keeping that on mind, what will be his next steps, in your opinion?
Well, so he's in Ukraine now. If we give him a victory in Ukraine, if we capitulate in these peace negotiations that are going on, he's already, as we said, in Georgia acting. He's already in Moldova acting. He's changed the way he approaches Nagorno-Karabakh. So he already has several spots. But everyone is afraid, and some of the people who study believe that he may attack a NATO nation at some point in the next 5 to 7 years.
Could you guess which one that would be?
Yeah, I'd rather not guess. Most people talk about the Baltic nations would be the first target. But I think something that's important to understand is we used to, during the Cold War, we had conventional deterrence all over Europe. And his predecessors and others understood that the NATO alliance and the West stood at the wall and we were going to defend. Since that time, the nations of the West have changed their approach. We have very good deterrence still in NATO nations, but non-NATO nations, Mr. Putin believes, are completely fair game. And that's why he's attacking into Georgia, attacking into Moldova, attacking into Ukraine. These are all non-NATO nations.
And do you think if a NATO country will be attacked, the NATO will work as an organization?
I think the question you're asking me is, if we are attacked, will we react in accordance with Article 5? I do believe that.
There are people who say that won't happen because a small country will be attacked and that will destroy the NATO as a defense organization.
I've heard that. I don't agree.
Why don't you agree?
So during my time, when Russia attacked into Ukraine, the border nations with Russia were very nervous, and they came to us as the NATO commander, and they said, what are you going to do about this? And NATO, as I told you, was all about doing business at that time, not doing war with Russia. And so NATO chose not to take any action. And so 5-6 weeks, I can't remember exactly, later, Russia once again invaded Ukraine. Now they came across the land border into the Donbas region, Lugansk and Donetsk, in that area. Again, these people came to NATO headquarters and said, now it was more nations, said, what are you going to do about this? And once again, politically, the North Atlantic Council chose not to respond. So what happened is the U.S. European Command commander, who is me, also as the SACEUR, I went to President Obama and said, we need to take action. And President Obama said, take action. And so the United States acted and started moving forces into the Baltic nations. And as soon as we did that, four or five of the big nations came with us. The United Kingdom, Spain, and others came and joined us. So a coalition of the willing came to the front. And then all of NATO said, we can't let them be alone and we're not in. And within about 10 days, all of NATO was there fighting. But the main thing is, people forget that Article 5 certainly says if one attacked, we're all attacked. But in America, we look at our Article 5 commitment as having, back in my day, 27 individual bilateral relationships saying we have to defend. And that's why America brought American forces to the defense of the Baltics and Poland, and then the rest of NATO followed. And that's the way I think will happen in the real world. If we have this political conversations where things go, what's happening, I think the big nations of NATO will step up.
But the U.S. President Donald Trump once mentioned that the U.S. maybe could leave the NATO. How would the situation look?
Do you remember the first time that Donald Trump was the president and all of the hard language he had about NATO and didn't know that we needed to be in it? You remember that?
Yes.
So the fact are that during Donald Trump's first presidency, the U.S. troop presence in Europe climbed. The U.S. investment in military infrastructure in Europe increased. And the U.S. participation in big, large force exercises, specifically Trident Juncture, went up. So for all the hard things he said, in actuality, during his 4 years, our troop presence went up, our infrastructure went up, our participation in exercises went up. So I think we need to just take it easy and listen and understand and watch. This week, Mr. Putin once again sort of embarrassed America and embarrassed our president. If he keeps doing that, the rhetoric about NATO will change.
Just on a hypothetical level, how would the situation look like if the U.S. withdraws from the NATO?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
Yeah, I will talk about it, but I'm not going to address it in that context. I think that this is a very alarmist position to talk about. It would be very hard for our president to withdraw us from NATO. Remember that there is a Congress. The Congress controls all the money. And on the left and on the right, there is strong, strong leadership and strong positions about NATO is the right place to be. I don't allow these alarmist things to bother me.
How detailed are you looking on these developments now?
Very. I'm in Europe every 5 or 6 weeks. I'm here now 20 days, 4 capitals. I go home for 10 days. I come back for 12 days, 4 more capitals. I'm dealing all the time with my former friends and colleagues who are running NATO, and we're working these issues all the time.
So you're a retired general, but I guess you're still working. Would you like to tell us a little bit what you're doing now?
So yes, I retired after 39 years in military service, and I spent almost half of that in Europe. And now, as a retired officer, I have my own consulting firm, and that's what I'm doing now. I'm over here working with people, speaking at conferences. Spent time yesterday with your Secretary General of Policy. I'm out interacting with the leadership in Europe in my consultative business. I'm also teaching a little bit at university. You talked about my bachelor's degree. I also have basically 3 master's degrees, and I teach at university, only a limited basis, 3 or 4 days a month. And then I have a few small firms that I'm not like a CEO or anything like that, but I am on the board of several small firms who are trying to bring capabilities to our militaries.
When you were the SACEUR commander, where were you located?
So actually, you said in the introduction that I was stationed in Germany. The SACEUR, the U.S. headquarters is in Germany. But the SACEUR's home and where he spends most of his time is Mons, Belgium. The headquarters of Europe, of NATO in Europe, is in Belgium. The political headquarters is in Brussels, and the military headquarters is about an hour away in Mons. And so I lived in Mons, and that's where my headquarters was. But most SACEUR's are traveling maybe 2 weeks out of every month. When we were still fighting in Afghanistan, I was in Afghanistan 1 month, and then we had combat troops in Kosovo. So I went to Kosovo the next month, and then Afghanistan, then Kosovo, then Afghanistan. You have to be out in contact with your troops. And every SACEUR has a regular schedule to visit the NATO nations so that he can be exposed to their concerns and what their publics are talking about. So I lived in Mons, Belgium, but I was on the road half, sometimes more than half the time.
Is there any piece of advice you would give a young person who would like to join the Air Force or the Army?
I obviously think it is a great job. I have 3 children. One of them is in the Air Force. One of them worked for the U.S. Navy. And the other one is a scientist for our Special Operations Command. So all my children, in one way or another, are associated with the military. I would just tell folks that some people, this is a calling. You know, you're never going to be rich if you're in the military, at least in our military, because you are watched so closely with how you make money. But if your service for your nation and your patriotism in what your nation stands for is important to you, the military is a great place to be. And I would also say that, remember, I introduced myself as I came from a low-income family. I would have never been able to go to the schools I went to. I got a degree at our second best engineering school as an undergraduate. I went to Arizona State, which is an incredible college, for my first master's. I went to the National War College for my second master's. And then at MIT, I did a fellowship. And so these are incredible schools. If you want to have that kind of education and gain and be able to use that kind of experience, the military is a great place to be.
I think it was a good closing, sir. Thanks for having you here. Thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Well, thank you.
And to our listeners, thanks for listening. Until next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Militär Aktuell, the podcast. Visit us online at militäraktuell.at and subscribe to our printed magazine.